Well, do you remember when we actually had to used to have to do videos and stuff, which was just horrendously complicated, and we were
Hated it.
even stupider now than we even stupider than we are now. So
Yeah, I know. What if one can imagine such a time?
it's just painful. Yeah,
Usually so.
we should probably introduce this properly.
We probably should. Hello, everybody. This is the Right Dishonorable Podcast. My name is Jazza.
My name is
Who are
Jimmy.
you?
Oh,
You're Jimmy.
we're supposed to say proper names now. So I'm Jimmy Nichols, and you're Jazza John.
Great, excellent, good.
Yeah, so everyone knows now who we are, and that's fine.
I am so glad. If you've gotten this far to episode 19 and you're not sure who we are, I commend your persistence.
There's probably people coming and listening in from the latest episodes, maybe even going backwards into the extensive back catalogue now.
Hey, it would be lovely to hear from you if you are. Please leave us rates on ratings and comments on iTunes. It makes us feel very loved.
So what are we talking about again? I've already forgotten.
Oh
This is
God.
going to go very well.
So for some context, we're recording this quite late in the evening on Sunday. We've had long weekends. I had a stag do yesterday, actually, by the way. So I'm not at my most nimble intellectually, I don't think. But we're gonna continue anyway because we love to do the podcast. And we're also doing this over Skype, so there may be some lag, but like, fuck it. Why am I explaining this? So this week we are going to be talking about, first of all, well, we're gonna react to a piece that was written on Breitbart. Which what Jimmy, why do you read Breitbart?
I just find it fascinating, and they often slag off feminists, which I find kind of amusing on just many levels. And occasionally they say something I agree with, but mostly they just sort of pretend that climate change isn't real, and
For the
lots of
layman,
other
what
fun
is
things.
Breitbart, Jimmy?
I mean, I was about to describe it as if UKIP had its own news source, and as it turns out, the editor of Breitbart London is actually a former UKIP aide of some sort, called Raheem
I
something.
think that's what we call coincidence.
Yeah, that's pure coincidence, but it's actually kind of entertaining, and in it's got a very distinctive writing style. But this particular article,
It's by Milo Yiannopoulos, who is kind of like the right darling kind of token gay. And I
You
do
say
find
token
him.
gay, there's quite a lot of prominent gay conservatives, isn't there? Am I just
So
making
I
that
feel
up?
like I don't think you are, but he's rolled out as like the hard line anti-feminist gay man, I feel, who is very entertaining in what he says, but is quite vile in the way that he says quite a lot of what he
I
says.
mean, one of his articles that I read ages ago started with something to the effect of like transsexualness isn't even really a thing, they're just pretending. And that very much sets the tone for quite a lot of his articles, I'd have thought.
So we're basically going to be reacting to an article that he wrote about the fact that gay men and feminists are going to go their separate ways, and the left is going to divorce with gay men. It's actually, apart from all of the vitriol, it's actually a very interesting article and an interesting concept. So we're going to talk about that. Secondly, we will talk about the fact that the Right Dishonourable has got a new member. Who's that, Jimmy?
Oh God, yeah.
Oh my
You totally lost me there, but what Jazza is referring to is the fact that Jeremy Corbyn, because he hasn't turned up at Privy Council, is now being referred to as the Honourable Jeremy Corbyn as opposed to the Right Honourable Jeremy Corbyn.
He should be called the Right Dishonourable, and then like we'd get loads of hits.
Would we though? Or I don't know. I don't think people are going to be
We'd
Googling.
get some more hits.
I mean, the name is really clever, but you tell it to people who, even people who are interested in politics, and they look at you kind of confusedly. So,
I don't
yeah.
think confusedly is a word. I'm just going to put that
It
out there.
is it
But
is now. It is now.
we're going to talk about whether it's important that Corbyn doesn't want to be part of the Privy Council and kiss the hand of the Queen. As a Republican, he probably feels a bit uneasy about that. And finally, we will talk about the first Democratic presidential candidate debates, which had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders face off, among others.
Other people are available.
Other Democrats are available, but probably won't do very well. Shall we go into music now?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. So this Breitbart article, Jazza, I sent it over to you because I thought it would be of interest, because it discusses a potential schism between gay men and feminists. When you were reading through this article, what was your immediate reaction, or your first reaction, I should say?
Can I just say, the manner in which you sent this to me was quite hilarious, because you just posted the link and went, thoughts? I was like, okay. And then click through and it's a Milo Yiannopoulos. And I enjoy watching the videos that Milo puts up, and I enjoy seeing the tweets that he posts and reading the stuff that he writes, in the same way that I every now and again will read the Daily Mail, just to remind myself that there are worse people out there.
He's far more intelligent than the average Daily Mail.
I'm being unfair. And I am actually in a quite a weird way a fan of Milo Yiannopoulos. I quite enjoy his brash style. But basically, let me give you, where is it? There's a quote where he talks about penises. Hold on.
Control left penis.
Control left.
Find the penis.
I literally just went control find and wrote penis into my browser. He says, by the way, as for the open letters to white gay men about appropriating black culture, park it, sweetheart. We each had more black schlong in us than the Kardashian family. It's like, great, excellent. But basically what he's arguing is that quite a lot of the ideals, specifically of third wave feminism, are quite counteracting to the kind of like the gay male movement, and that gay, especially white men, are just not going to feel like feminism is something they're going to onboard themselves with.
Yiannopoulos actually maintains, you mentioned like LGBT, but he maintains that transsexuality and even being a lesbian, that he maintains these are not really things, which is just weird.
Let's just gloss over those things.
So he's talking very specifically about gay men and not really any of the other letters of the LGBT, you know, etc.
Spectrum. Which is why I checked myself before I said LGBT. So feminism aside, in the article he also talks about the fact that the left will end up divorcing itself from the gay movement. And I think that there is some truth in that to a certain extent. I think that naturally gay men, especially gay white men, are probably going to be more likely to have right or centre-right leaning politics, especially fiscally, when it comes to where they land on the political spectrum.
Why do you think that is?
If it's sensibly, because the majority of us are one person households and no commitments to children. And so that demographic tends to earn a lot more money than, say, a working class family, and don't have to consider stuff like education for their children or healthcare for their children and all those kind of things. And so are kind of less tapped into the welfare state than perhaps other demographics. And so in that sense, I think that there is certain truth to it. We also, the party in the UK with the largest number of queer MPs is the Conservatives. There are more gay men in the Conservatives than there are any other.
Is that an absolute number, or is that as a proportion as well? Because bearing in mind, the Tories are the largest party.
They are. I think it's as a proportion too, although I I suspect that the SNP actually, by proportion, have a larger number. But the Conservatives do not have a problem when it comes to gay representation, especially gay male representation. And the reason that I think that Milo kind of equates the left with gay rights is because traditionally, specifically in places like America, gay rights have kind of been linked to the divorcing of political, like political thought from religion. And so that has naturally happened on like the left wing of like American politics. Whereas because the right is very much like God bless America, and very religiously focused, there's the majority of like the legislative blocks to LGBT rights have been because of religious reasons. And so I think there is that,
even in Britain where you don't really have the religious things so much, it still is the case that you'd normally associate LGBT rights with the left, right? If that makes sense.
I think so, but I don't think that that is necessarily very correct. So, like, we've got a bit of a dodgy past with the Conservative Party with Proposition 8.
Yeah.
And the fact that they kept the ages of consent at the same. Like, Proposition 8 basically meant that you weren't allowed... Proposition 28... Or what was it? Not proposition.
Is it Section 28? 28.
Section 28. There you go. Thank you very much. Section 28 basically said that an out gay person would not be allowed to... it's very similar to the Russian law they have at the moment.
I thought it was not allowed to teach. Yeah, I thought it was that teachers could be gay, but they weren't allowed to talk to children about gay rights or homosexuality or what have you.
Exactly. And I feel like that is more of a product of the time in general. I think that most people on all like points of the political spectrum tended to be more homophobic in that sense of think of the children, the poor little children. What if they see that gay men hold hands sometimes? Oh, it's terrible. But then we can't ignore, especially in modern Britain, that it was a conservative-led government in the last government in the coalition that brought through gay marriage, which for many people is seen as like the final frontier in terms of like gay equality. I think that there are lots of other hurdles for us to overcome. I've talked about them in the past.
But when Cameron was pushing through gay marriage, there wasn't significant opposition from the Lib Dems or from Labour or from really any of the other parties apart from some of the Northern Irish parties weren't too happy about it, but the main opposition was from within the Conservative Party, wasn't it?
It was, but I think that that's also just because there's a lot of old people in it. It seems like a very simplistic way of putting it, but it's probably a fair point. And like equating marriage being just between a man and a woman is definitely more likely the older you are.
So we've slightly diverted here talking about like the relationships of gay rights to the different parts of the political spectrum, but the thrust of Yiannopoulos' article this time is about the way that feminism has gone in a sort of more, it's very difficult to actually explain this without actually putting a spin on it, but a slightly more authoritarian stance in terms of regulating the way in people like women are portrayed in the media, for instance, and that sort of thing.
I think one of the things that he said quite interestingly was the fact that a lot of the kind of feminists that he are talking about, which are the very hardline, they're often derogatory, like called in a derogatory way, feminazis. So I feel like I'm treading on eggshells at the moment. But basically, the fact that they quite often seek to cushion everything, whereas gay men, and especially in terms of speech, whereas gay men traditionally have got a culture that is very brash and that is very aware of race and will use that into comedic effect, and will kind of call out people's like mannerisms and appropriate words like faggot and call each other fag and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of at odds with what Milo Yiannopoulos thinks is like the current wave of feminism that wants to kind of wrap us all in bubble wrap. And I think that there is that a conflict there, perhaps.
So you actually think he's right when he says that there's a kind of censorious element in whichever wave of feminism we're on now? I think it's actually the fourth wave at this point.
Are we on fourth? Oh, I'm lost then.
We should have found an actual feminist to come on and chat to us about this, but for planning.
Next week it'll happen. It'll happen. But basically, I think that he just has a very specific idea of what a feminist is. And there are the very hardline feminists who want to be very interventionist in society. But then I think that the majority of people who identify as feminists actually just want there to be equal opportunities for women and for there to be a system which allows for a woman to be able to do that. So that means stuff like shared parental leave when a child is born, equal pay for equal work, which actually still doesn't happen, despite what a lot of the right wing claim in that area. Equal, like, more balanced
a lot of people you can say they're on the right, but they would actually look, I've looked at this argument, I can't really decide which I believe, but some people say the disparity in pay is more due to different choices in the labour market in terms of hours worked, which sector you work in, and that sort of thing.
So those choices are made because of the fact that it is traditionally a woman that has to give up her job in order to have a child, whereas there should be a societal shift that allows for there to be equal opportunity for both of the parents to be able to take time off work.
Yeah, so but I guess that depends. That kind of hinges on your view of whether women are just more naturally more inclined to sort of look after kids without actually the environmental culture stuff on the top. So it very much depends on your view of the disparity in behavior of the genders, whether that's down to biology or whether it's down to culture or the extent to which it's one or the other, if you see what I mean.
I do see what you mean. There's actually also something quite interesting that kind of like it came back into my consciousness while reading this article, and this was at the previous NUS conference, the National Union of Students, that one of their feminist fringes basically
I know what you're about to say.
Yeah, they voted to pass the motion that dear white cis gay men, stop appropriating black culture.
Yeah, I remember.
And so it basically meant stop being sassy and like, yes, work, yes, girl. Which was so problematic on so many levels because it just showed a huge lack of understanding of where gay culture comes from. Because the reason that there is a lot of black female culture in gay male culture as a whole is because that came into gay culture through the ballroom scene in the 1980s and the early 1990s and the 70s and the 80s actually, where it was the majority were African-American gay men that used to do drag and dress up, and a lot of the stuff that is seen as appropriated from black female culture actually comes from has permeated through into wider gay culture through the drag scene, through the African-American drag scene in the 70s and the 80s. Mm. And it was just like, that's just how culture works. Culture spreads. And we're not trying, there's no mockery in the way that we are campy and sassy and all of those sometimes used derogatory terms. It's just the culture that we now have that is very well ingrained in queer culture, and but it just
there,
and
there,
that
there seems to be there seems to be a bias within social justice warriors in themselves that if somebody finds something offensive, it sort of doesn't matter what the actual intention behind, say, a particular form of speech or a particular behavior is. The fact that somebody finds it offensive means that you have to stop, basically, whatever the reasoning behind what it is you're doing.
Yeah.
Damn it, Chazza. I need you to, like, try and rebut it at least.
No, no, but I do understand in certain circumstances why, when that particular kind of attitude towards offence being caused is correct. But this just showed a lack of understanding of where gay culture comes from. And actually is the fact that we celebrate the roots and the strong people that came before us who weren't able to hide their sexuality and who actually pioneered gay culture and meant that we ended up being a visible minority and people who ended up getting the same rights, at least in certain countries in the world. And to say, oh, you need to stop being, like, pretending to be a sassy black woman. And it just baffled me. It completely baffled me. Where I do think it is sometimes problematic is when a gay man will say, oh, yeah, I've got a black woman inside me. And on many levels, that's wrong. But
I don't know, but if he doesn't mean it in, like, a bad way, it seems very petty to say that has to be offensive, if you see what I mean.
No, it just doesn't sit very well with me. I think there is a better way of putting something like that across. It basically does what a lot of straight women do to gay people in the way that they fetishize us. They're often called faghads in that way. And they'll go on a bachelorette party to Soho or to Canal Street and go into a gay club and just be like, oh my, and like suck cocktails through penis-shaped straws and stuff. And that's the fetishization of gay culture, because they think that it's hilarious and it's bombastic and it's like ridiculous, basically. And I think that when somebody says every gay man has a sassy black woman inside them, I think that there's a similar thing in fetishizing black women to what like bachelorette parties. I'm kind of stretching it a little bit, I think, but there, I think it's a similar thing is happening.
There seems to be, like, when you get into this kind of cultural policing thing, it just becomes this insane, like, mess of who can trace back whatever further, who has ownership of this. And it, as you kind of say, or you kind of intimated earlier, the way culture works is it permeates throughout society, and it's, I mean, people steal stuff all the time from, you know, other people. You have blues music was originally a black thing in America, and then British people took it on and made rock music, and then it sort of goes back and forth that way. And yeah, in a sense, it is kind of pinching stuff, but I don't really see how this cultural policing thing can work.
That is, culture works. You can't have certain bubbles of culture. Culture is fluid and it blends. But there are points where there is this thing called appropriation, and I think cultural appropriation has come to mean anybody doing anything that is not what their ancestors used to do, and I think that that is wrong. Appropriation, I think, is bad and damaging when it is fetishization of culture, when it's mocking of culture, and when it is the belittling of culture. Otherwise, like the kind of adopting and the attempt to kind of understand certain parts of other cultures, I think, is a positive thing, and that is what happens, especially when we live in a globalized society, right?
Well, I would push it a lot further than you. I don't actually think you need to be celebrating, or you don't need to be being nice about somebody else's culture to do it. I think if you want to mock other cultures, I think that's kind of okay, and it disturbs me a little bit that there are people, I'm just going to call them social justice warriors because there's no better term for them, who basically want to stop that, and like they don't believe that is a legitimate course of free speech, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah. As a straight white man, as the token straight white man in this conversation, what did you think of Yiannopoulos's article, apart from that it was hilariously written?
I mean, they are
schlongs and all.
Yeah, schlongs and all. I thought it was it, because he was actually trying to say we don't actually need feminists in terms of advancing the gay agenda, and I don't mean that in a kind of sinister way. Whereas I don't really know. From my point of view, it's almost kind of hilarious to watch these various little groups kind of fight it out among themselves. And I found your your thoughts on it earlier around the general conservatism of gay men. That's actually pretty interesting, and that wasn't really my perception of it going into the piece. But I think broadly speaking, it kind of fits into Yiannopoulos's thesis that politics on the internet is less about left versus right and more about libertarian versus authoritarian. And I wouldn't say like feminists have no good points. I mean, we can talk about like the pay gap and the objectification of women, yada yada yada, but that it is
that's it, run off everything else with just yada yada yada.
Yeah, yeah, but what I'm saying is there are legitimate points. But by the same token, there's a lot of censorship and there's a lot of authoritarian policies being advocated and being put forward. You go ahead.
So one thing, I'm glad that I remembered this, because this is I think that this is really important. Gay male culture and feminism do have a huge overlap, and that is the perception of femininity being lesser and being weaker. Mm. And being and in gay culture, it's seen as a negative. If you are a sissy, if you're somebody who is particularly camp, if you're like a Graham Norton or a Jimmy Carr, not a Jimmy Carr. Yeah, no, it is Jimmy Carr.
Do you mean Alan Carr?
Alan Carr. Thank you. If you're a particularly camp, politically flamboyant, and particularly effeminate gay man, you're generally seen as like you're seen as something ridiculous and less sexualized in gay culture. I think this is my perception. If anybody disagrees with me, please do let me know. But there's part of this, oh, you are a man and therefore you should act like a man, otherwise you're just another gay sissy who's bowing to a stereotype. I certainly had some of those feelings when I was younger. I found camp gay men, I didn't really understand why they had to be camp, in quotation marks, whereas actually that's just how they are and that's how part of our culture is. Mm. And there isn't anything negative about men acting effeminate in any way. Like, why is that seen as a bad thing?
But is there like a greater sexual value put on macho gay men as opposed to camp gay men? Is it the macho gay men?
I would argue hugely. If you are quote unquote straight acting, then you are coveted and you are lusted after. You're so man. You see this on dating profiles quite a lot. You'll see masculine for masculine. No camp people. I like my men to be men. And all of that kind of stuff, and really shaming effeminate gay men. And that is something that the feminist cause, I think, does really well in terms of saying it doesn't matter if somebody is a butch lesbian or a sissy gay man or a particularly effeminate straight man or whatever. You have a value. You should be seen as having value in the society, and you shouldn't be belittled for the way that you decide to express your gender identity. Mm. Right. And so I think that that is one of the strongest things, that is a huge overlap between feminism and gay culture.
So, I mean, with that in mind, do you think that Yiannopoulos's broad point that feminism and gay rights are about to split and that they will no longer be campaigning for one another, or they'll no longer be allies, do you think that's true or do you think that's wrong?
I don't know if they have ever officially been allies. I think because there are overlaps on kind of the way that the two kind of movements have happened in terms of social equality and things like that, and also like gender expression and your like quite libertarian views in how somebody expresses their gender. Mm. There is common ground, but I don't know if they have ever been tethered to one another. I think they have been two separate campaigns, and when they have come together, they've come together. But I don't think that there's anything that particularly intertwines the two of them in terms of like an organisational or political level.
Right, and on the kind of point about feminism, because we've talked about like this perception that feminism is becoming more authoritarian. Do you think that's actually true, and do you think there's going to be a backlash to that, or do you think that will be generally quite well received in terms of general progressive politics and wider politics as well.
I feel like there's the types of feminists that Yiannopoulos is talking about, annoying, because that part of feminism is so insular. But then there's really annoying people that you find in every single social kind of group and social cause.
So you don't actually think of yourself as a feminist then, or
no? I'm a feminist, but there's different types of feminists.
But I think he's not just talking about like the we need to castrate men and harvest their semen and then like make sure there's no more men type of feminist. He's talking more about the kind of no more Page Free Brigade, as far as I can make out.
I don't know. I think that he has an image of a feminist in his head that is no more Page Free. I understand why people are campaigning for that, and that's fine. And I don't necessarily think that should be legislated against. Mm. I think that it's foul, and I think that it's a horrible part of our culture that we basically have pornography on one of our best-selling newspapers in the country. But I wouldn't want to legislate for that. And I know lots of feminists who also wouldn't want to legislate for that. And to say,
but there's feminists who won't legislate, but they'll happily sort of, put in commercial pressure and sort of hassle stores and all this sort of thing. So they might not actually make it illegal, but they'll go through other methods to actually make it as difficult as possible for, people to sell the sun, for instance.
I don't really have a problem with that. It's forms of protest, and we should have a varied ways of being able to put our point across and to have opinions. I don't see a problem with that. I disagree with them, but they should be able to do what they want.
I'm not disputing they have the right to have a protest, but it seems a little bit rich to claim.
Sounds like you were going fascist there.
Well, I think they're going kind of fascist, if anything. I mean, that's why they're called feminazis, right?
But it's the painting of everybody as the really loud voices on Twitter. If there's people who identify as feminists who end up acting in a particular way, then that means that all feminists are bad. I worry that that is what Yiannopoulos is... It's what he persistently says, and the reason that he has a vendetta against feminism because it gets him a ton of clicks. Yeah. I have no doubt he doesn't believe what he says, but that is one of the reasons why he continually goes after this group. But like you kind of have to understand that there are groups in like these movements that the rest of the groups don't necessarily agree with, and they don't necessarily have the tactics with.
See, I don't feminism is obviously really varied, and there's actually feminists who would both call themselves feminists, but they might have views that are actually utterly conflicting and not compatible at all. So in that sense, yeah, you can't criticize feminism, but I feel that the type of feminism that's most prevalent in our media, say, I don't know if that's reflective of the reality more generally, but I think there is a genuine authoritarian strain in the way that they think about things. And if you chat to sort of people who've been involved in politics for sort of going back to the 80s, going back to the 70s, they'll say this kind of impulse was always somewhat in feminism, but it appears that it's become more important, I think, or at least that's my perception anyway.
Okay. We've talked about this for a long time.
We have, yes. I'm sure we really should get an actual feminist on to, discuss.
I'm working on it. Everybody's really busy.
Stop being busy. What is more important?
Than the right dishonourable, obviously.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Jeremy Corbyn being less honourable now. Jeremy Corbyn is now no longer referred to as the Right Honourable Jeremy Corbyn. He's referred to as just the Honourable Jeremy Corbyn. That's because he has refused to go to something which is called the Privy Council, which is basically meant to be the Queen and her closest advisors on national and international issues. One of the reasons that the reason that Jeremy Corbyn has decided to, rather than go to the Privy Council and be sworn in, he decided to go on holiday, on a walking holiday to Scotland, is because he's a staunch Republican, always has been, probably always will be. And so he thought that it was a conflict of his interest. There's problems.
I think he's going to be sworn in at some point. I don't think he... I think so. Because mostly the Privy Council is a rubber stamping body. It's where the government takes legislation that has already effectively been passed and says to the Queen, just sign this, please. But there's all, if you're a member of the Privy Council, you're also given access to security briefings around issues of national security,
specifically with Syria, he's not going to be able to be briefed on the Syrian crisis, and there's thoughts that David Cameron is going to have another vote on the Syrian question on whether we should intervene there. Do you think that this is going to be? Why do you think that they're going to bypass it and let him in? Because it looks like they're being pretty staunch about it.
Well, there's this whole thing of like he has to kneel and kiss the Queen's hand, but there was an article in Private Eye the other day which said it's actually pretty common for Republicans to be sworn in to the Privy Council for one reason or another. You just pretend that you have like a bad knee and then you don't have to go through the whole genuflection thing and it's fine. This is apparently a normal thing. It's happened hundreds of times in the past, and the Queen and her advisors, whatever, have a ceremony, have like a ritual for getting around it, as it were.
Why has the media decided to make this such a big deal then? Is it because they hate him? It's because they hate him, isn't it?
I think it's because the sort of stories you can write about him not interacting with the monarchy, not singing the national anthem, what have you, sell papers. I don't think the media has it in, well, some of them do have it in for him in and of itself, but I think a lot of them just know that the stories are kind of more interesting than your usual kind of policy fair. So yeah,
it's somebody who's going against the grain, right?
Yeah, he is, but I don't know, it's all very trivial and quite tedious most of the time, and also not very well informed. I mean, there was a, when it emerged that he was not turning up at this first Privy Council meeting, the first one he could turn up to, it was a Telegraph piece, and the guy who wrote it, I think, was Christopher Hope, who's one of the political correspondents at the Telegraph. And he chose not to mention, or he wasn't aware, that David Cameron took 3 months before he got sworn in. Which, when you put the story in that context, it's not really a story at all. And people were tweeting him saying, you know, this is, you haven't actually added this vital piece of context. And he just wasn't listening. He just was refusing to acknowledge that he'd made a mistake.
This has been turned into a huge smear campaign on Jeremy Corbyn, hasn't it? Why have they gotten away with this?
I don't, because most people aren't interested.
Tell me about these injustices, Jimmy.
That's just the way the news operates in this country. I don't really know what to say.
But even with Ed Miliband, there were people who came to his, he had support, right? And I feel like there isn't that, there's his social justice warriors on Twitter, but past that, there doesn't seem to be anybody really fighting his corner.
Well, a lot of people.
But do you think I'm wrong in that?
No, you're right, because a lot of people who write for The Guardian and The Independent, which and actually The New Statesman as well, which are the main left-wing publications, are to the right of Jeremy Corbyn. They'd probably be more easily classified as Blairites. There's some exceptions to that. People like Owen Jones for The Guardian, probably people like Laurie Penny for The New Statesman. But by and large, they're like Blairites, or they're more moderate left-wing supporters. So the only newspaper that really has Jeremy Corbyn's back, there'd be things like
The New Statesman.
No, it would be things like The Morning Star, maybe
I don't even really know what that is, I'll be honest.
It used to be like the official paper of the Communist Party of Great Britain.
Lovely.
It actually used to be funded by the communist USSR. So it was, you know, directly a propaganda
tool. That's
tool.
Fantastic yeah. company to be keeping, isn't it?
It's not great. I mean, there's other things like Red Pepper, which is kind of a similar-ish magazine, and the New Internationalist or something, which I think is a socialist. It's run as a cooperative or something. But yeah, that it's like, if you don't have any friends in the media, then yeah, you're going to get like battered by the press and no one will come and save you. So that's sad, I guess.
Do you think that this is basically going to mean, how long has he got, do you reckon? Because if this onslaught keeps on happening and no stories being treated as like week-long stories, which is what this has turned into, how long has he got, the poor guy? Because it must, like, I don't agree with very much of what Jeremy Corbyn believes, but I'm just starting to feel a bit sorry for it.
I think, well, it'd be interesting to see what you think about this, but I think he's got until the May elections, which are local council elections,
the
Scottish election, the election for Scottish Parliament is at the same time, and also the London mayoral election, although that won't be so much a reflection of him because Sadiq Khan, who's Labour's candidate for London mayor, isn't really affiliated with him.
Did you see Sadiq Khan on Have I Got News For You?
I did, and I thought that was very telling as to the relationship between Sadiq Khan and Corbyn, because he didn't even really bother to defend him.
No, not at all. And so the reason that Sadiq won over somebody like Tessa, because Sadiq was kind of being told told to all of the new members that Sadiq was like the left-wing version, was kind of like the Jeremy Corbyn of the mayor pre-selection, of the Labour mayor pre-selection process. And so it's kind of seems a bit rich, really. He seems quite happy to chuck him under the bus after all of it.
Well, I guess that's the advantage of like the London mayoralty as an office, is that you can be an outside figure in your own party. I mean, Ken Livingston, Boris Johnson, both examples of that. And you can get away with slagging off your own party and they'll be like, well, we can't really do anything to you because if we like kick you out of the party, then you'll just run as an independent and probably win anyway. So I don't know. It's I think Corbyn's got until May. And if those elections go badly, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about it?
He's buggered. Bless him.
are we both assuming that he's not going to make it until 2020? Is that have we already agreed on that?
Yeah, he won't. Mainly because I don't think that somebody like Tristram Hunt is going to be able to stand being out of the public eye for that long. To be completely honest, he's not a man made for being a backbencher, is he? I wanted to ask you, as the token Republican on the Right Dishonour, how would you deal with this? If you were Corbyn and you had to possibly kiss the Queen's hand, although apparently you don't kiss the Queen's hand, you rub your nose on her hand.
This is according to Have I Got News For You, isn't it?
Yes, which is a great news source. Everybody should use it as their weekly dose. But what would you do in this circumstance?
I'd just agree to be sworn in to the Privy Council. I probably would have sung the national anthem, for instance, even though I'm not that much of a fan of the national anthem. But
you'd rather the Queen were not saved by God.
I feel God probably has better things to do than save some 80-year-old woman who, frankly, has had quite a nice life and pretty good innings already. You know, there's.
I think that's treason.
I mean, he also does.
Sing that duly.
He also doesn't exist, so it frankly doesn't matter who he saves or doesn't save.
Well, so that's all the monarchists and all of the religious people now no longer listening to the podcast, Jimmy.
Well, you know. I'm just telling the truth, you know, I'm just trying to be honest with people.
Just saying it like it is. So would you criticise Corbyn for the way that he's handled this?
Well, the thing about like the Republican thing is, like they do polls every so often.
The Republican thing.
I think that we should get rid of the Queen, but I'm also aware that 80% of the country does not share my particular view on that. And 80% is like the lower boundary. It's also...
Well, you do know what it feels like to be a minority.
I'm far more persecuted than you are, Jazza. I mean...
Definitely.
Have you seen the BBC's coverage of Republicans? It's terrible.
Yeah, but like they have charter renewal. I'm giving the BBC a free pass on everything they post at the moment.
Well, this was even before they had charter renewal. But yeah, I mean, Corbyn hasn't made a big deal out of any of this, but he has made some very stupid moves. And one of them, like, he should, like, Privy Council, there's no way he didn't realise there was some sort of swearing an oath to the Queen, because if you're a Republican, you probably read a fair bit about the monarchy in the same way that, you know, militant atheists read a lot about religion. He must have realised that was part of the deal when you become leader of the opposition. And he should have just said, yeah, I'm just going to do it. Obviously, I don't believe we should have a monarchy, but it's part of my job. And people would have accepted that. They would have said, that's fine, you know.
Fine.
Actually, the Telegraph and the Mail probably would have called him a hypocrite, but people would be over it by now. And he's done that. He's kind of done the thing that Hillary Clinton did with the email server in the States, is that...
What, laugh at every opportunity?
No, just deal with it head on. It, like, there's bad stories that the press will throw at you, and the best thing to do is to just deal with them in the way that will actually minimise the amount of press coverage, which means confronting them. Just don't ignore them, because people will continue writing about it and continue to, you know, question you, and it will make you look bad in the long term. So,
well, I'm very glad that you brought up Miss Clinton, because we're now going to talk about the Republican primary debate.
Wait, shouldn't we talk about this U-turn with John McDonnell a little bit?
Oh, I don't think we have time.
So basically, there was John McDonnell supported the fiscal charter, then said he didn't support it. It was very embarrassing. Everyone laughed. The fiscal charter was passed anyway because the Tories have a majority. The end.
Why did we think that we needed to dedicate more minutes to that? We're going to talk about the Democrats now.
Democrats.
The Democrats.
The other ones.
The other ones. The ones that have the Hillary.
So, Jazza, this week the Democrats finally got around to having their first primary debate. The Republicans already having had two. And you stayed
excessive.
You stayed up to watch some of it, didn't you? And then you...
Oh, no, the Democrat one. I Sky Plus'd that shit. Okay, I'm over staying up until 3 o'clock in the morning now.
Okay, so you showed no dedication to to the podcast, didn't even watch it live. This is shameful, but you did watch it eventually. It seems that most of the American press, at least, ran with Hillary winning the debate. Was that your impression as well?
See, this is very interesting, because the press almost unanimously have said, yeah, Hillary won it. Like, Hillary, not just that Hillary won it, Hillary walked it. But then most of the polls afterwards of viewers said that Bernie Sanders won. So Bernie Sanders is the Jeremy Corbyn of the Democrats. He describes himself as a socialist, which is like unheard of in the USA, who for the longest time being called a socialist was like the deepest, darkest insult that you throw at somebody. But he's like galvanizing a huge number of people in the USA at the moment. He's the person who, bar none, has had the largest rallies. He's had regularly been turning out thousands, tens of thousands of people. And his really built up campaign, especially on social media, and he has a large number of young people, especially kind of backing him. I feel like, in my opinion, out of the two of them, they came out of it pretty evenly. If anything, I think that Hillary came across as too comfortable sometimes. So there was a point in the debate where everybody was kind of agreeing, let's stop talking about Hillary's emails and get on to talking about policy. And she was asked, do you want to respond to that? And she went, no.
was just very. I think that she was overly comfortable on stage, and there's little she can do about that because she is very comfortable on stage because she's done this a few times already. But I think that that may have been to her detriment. Whereas Bernie Sanders was very, very, very impassioned about the whole thing. Those are my opinions on it.
I've just realised I've actually seen Hillary Clinton speak when I was out in America for some tech conference of
bloody
some sort.
Bloody hell! When did what?
Yeah, this was like last October. So it was probably a year ago this week or something.
Bastard.
I find her deeply unimpressive, and I don't understand why anyone votes for her except begrudgingly because she's, you know, the best of a bad bunch. I don't understand how anyone could express any enthusiasm for her because they're just
she lacks policy at the moment, but I feel like that is going to change as we get closer to the actual election.
She's very much, from my point of view, like the Yvette Cooper of American politics, in that she's she's obviously like quite qualified for the role. I mean, I think Yvette.
I mean, she's prodigiously qualified.
Yeah, but
like Barack Obama, in comparison, he was a first-term senator, I believe, a first or second-term senator. He hadn't even been in national politics for very long.
Yeah, something like that, but she doesn't seem to have any policies, and the policies that she does have, it seems as though she's picked them just because she thinks they're popular, as opposed to actually wanting to, you know, wanting them in and of themselves.
That's true for all of the candidates at the moment. I don't think anybody really has very, like, clear policy. This is how I'm going to do stuff. Yet we're still very early in the process.
But Bernie Sanders, as you said, he's a socialist. He actually believes in things, whether his ideas are any good, your mileage may vary, but he has like a long record, and he obviously is a man of principles. He's kind of like the Jeremy Corbyn of American politics. Which probably means that he will ultimately not be a great candidate because his support is too narrow. And I guess the good thing about Clinton, from a purely cynical Democratic point of view, that's Democratic as in the party rather than the general term. You'd want her to win because you'd think she's probably got the best opportunity for mass appeal, because of how famous she is and because of how nebulous her actual principles are.
Yeah.
We're gonna try and argue that one.
So what was really I think where there was more interesting kind of like the, what was more interesting about the debate was that the light was shone on the other three Democratic people running for the nomination. Namely Lincoln Chafee, Martin O'Malley, and Jim Webb. And so two of these guys, like, shriveled in the direct sunlight of media, of like a national media glare. Them being Lincoln Chafee, basically completely humiliating himself. It was about voting for the Iraq, maybe voting for the Iraq war, but he basically said that he voted on a particular bill on his first day in the Senate because he didn't really know what he was doing.
Wow.
And so he voted a certain way and didn't really know. And he was like, give me a break. Like, it was my first day, blah, 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 blah. he didn't do particularly well.
I mean, that is very strong. That is.
Yeah, very... exactly.
Wow.
Jim Webb, he was just a bit, I mean, flat and toad-like. He didn't really do very much. Incredibly forgettable. Martin O'Malley, Sean. Martin O'Malley actually did really, really well. And he is kind of like, he's very close to Hillary, I think, in that he's like the center ground of the Republican Party, of the Democratic Party, sorry. And I can see him probably, I reckon that Hillary might ask him to be her VP. I called it now.
Okay. I mean, a lot of people have been discussing the prospect of the current vice president, Joe Biden, running for office. Do you actually think that's likely? And also, what effect do you actually think it would have on the race?
So I know some people in Washington. And the common consensus is apparently that he's going to get into the race. The thing is, he has a deadline. If you want to get onto the ballot in every single one of the states, which is kind of, you know,
pretty important.
Seen as key. It's like the beginning of November is your deadline. So he has to declare pretty soon.
A lot of people have also said that he's damaged his race in the sense that a lot of the best Democratic campaigners have signed up to Hillary's campaign, and had he declared...
Yeah, they can jump ship, though.
Can they jump ship? Okay.
Yeah, of course they can jump ship.
So you don't think that'll be a problem, then?
No, not at all. I think... So the reason that he's kind of stalling, because very often the vice president will run for the nomination. Hmm. Like, that's how the first George Bush... got into became president. He was the previous VP. The main reason, and what's seen as the main reason why Joe Biden is kind of stalling, is because he's had a series of really terrible like family tragedies. He had to bury his son earlier this year, and so it would be based upon whether or not his family like are going to be up for that amount of scrutiny. But the people seem to think that he is going to run, which could be very exciting. And so the consequences of that is inevitably that he eats into Hillary's poll numbers.
So does that mean that Bernie Sanders has a better chance of winning if Joe Biden runs?
It does. So it splits the centrist vote. Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton are both quite centrist in the Democrat Party, whereas Bernie Sanders is the outlier, the socialist, the left-wing guy. And so they will just inevitably take votes off of each other, unless they like have to tack in a particular direction to appease a certain demographic, which would be it would hypothetically inevitably be what happens.
But is it in the American primary system, isn't it generally whittled down to two candidates in the end, or is that not the way it works?
I don't think it's official, but I think by courtesy, once you've gone through a few of the primaries, by Super Tuesday, it usually is just down to two.
Okay. And Super Tuesday is when which states vote? There's a handful.
There's like loads of them. Hold on, let me Google it. It wouldn't be the right dishonorable if we didn't Google.
I thought we preferred just to get things wrong and then not admit it.
No, we've gotten much better now. Oh God! So it is when.
Might have to do some editing magic at this point.
More delegates can be won on Super Tuesday than on any single day in the primary calendar. So in 2008, for example, so it's like loads. It's like over 20 states select their candidates.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so... As it stands, having actually seen the debate and discussed the prospect of Joe Biden running, who do you think is going to win at this point? Because earlier in the year, we kind of went with... I think we went with the majority opinion that Hillary Clinton was just going to sweep the board, and now it seems far less certain.
I think she's going to have a rocky ride, but I think she will still win. But, it's a very exciting game. We don't know. It's less chaotic... and much less chaotic than the Republican side. But I think, so basically, when you see the TV numbers, it was over 10 million people watching this debate, and over 20 million people watched the Republican one, but that's because Donald Trump is there and he's hilarious. But there's a huge amount of interest in this, and that's like one of the really interesting things. And there's like a want for debate in the US. It's like even on this side. So people aren't just thinking, Hillary's going to get it. they want to see what the other options are. And I think that that is interesting, and that sounds good.
See, we thought earlier as well that we were going to see a Clinton-Bush contest, but that's actually not looking very, very likely at this point, is it?
No, our Jeb is doing terribly, like really badly. Bless his cotton socks.
So who do you, as you say, it's pretty chaotic at the moment. And it seems to be that Donald Trump and the neurosurgeon Ben Carson are
out in front. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but surely neither of them will actually end up leading the Republicans.
I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
Do you think it's a genuine possibility that Donald Trump could actually get the Republican nomination? Is that a thing that could actually happen?
Theoretically, yes. So what's interesting is that since Jeb Bush's polling numbers have kind of collapsed, he has been really replaced by Marco Rubio, who is the senator from Florida, who is quite young. I think he's like in his early 40s. And he is kind of seen now as the mainstream Republican candidate and like the establishment candidate. So I would I would keep my eye out for him, basically. And also there's my bae, Carly Fiorina. I think she's really good. I'd like her to get it.
Really?
Yeah, I really like her, apart from when she talks about abortion, which is most of the time.
aside from the whole women's rights thing.
Yeah, it's fine. But then there's also, really interestingly, John Kasich from Ohio, which is like a key swing state in the US.
I actually saw him in the first Republican debate, and I was relatively impressed by him as it goes.
Yeah. So he, like, if he holds on, because like eventually, as all of these people kind of drop out, because there's still like 14 Republicans running for president, all of those vote shares are going to be distributed somewhere. John Kasich, if he holds on, could actually do a reasonably good innings in this. But yeah, I'm loving it. It's so entertaining. I love it.
But I mean, we've kind of talked about this purely from like a horse race point of view. Is there any actual like more substantial policy kind of angle that you have on it in terms of who wins the Republican or Democrat ticket, or who wins generally as well?
I will say one thing about the, because this was meant to be about the Democrats, I'll stick to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that's really interesting that contrasts what we can perceive in the Obama presidency and all of the candidates that were on stage in the previous week, they were much more ready to bash the Republicans. Whereas Barack Obama never, even when he was campaigning in 2007, he never really did that. He was also always very much trying to paint himself as the president who was going to be able to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans, and he never chastised Republicans. Ironically, that's got pretty much gone down the drain, but even over his presidency, he's been very respectful of using the R word and not using it as like a downer. Whereas the Democrats who were on stage last week, they all like quite happily laid into Republicanism as a concept.
At this point, American politics is so polarized and so divided. It's not surprising, is it?
But that may be interesting when there is finally a candidate selected for the Democratic ticket, and then they have to try and get Republican swing voters to vote for them.
I assume that you'd actually prefer a Democrat in the White House than a Republican, right?
I don't particularly care. For comedy purposes, I'd quite like Donald Trump to do it.
I mean, for comedy and apocalyptic purposes
as
well.
Yeah, just think of the lols.
The lols and the excruciating death when nuclear bombs are dropped around the world.
Whee! Three, two, one, clap. The delay is hilarious.
It's also quite hard to clap whilst holding a microphone. It's difficult logistically.
Poor baby.
It's my life is so hard. It's so hard.
I know white cis man straight as well. Oh, Jesus. Privately educated.
It's harder than it sounds, all right. I mean, it's... I've had enough of your enough of your bigotry, Jazza, you know. Putting me down.
Fuck off and write for Breitbart.
They won't let me because, you know, I believe in... I'm actually too left-wing for Breitbart, which isn't really saying very much, but...